What's going on, guys? Chris here, and I wanted to take a moment before we get into today's episode to tell you about the Warrior Soul Goji. That's our website. It's at www.warriorsoulagoge.com. The Goji was a concept developed in ancient Sparta. It's where they sent their young boys in order to learn how to become hardened Spartan warriors. At our Goji, you're going to learn about things like increasing your mental and physical performance through nutrition and exercise, as well as learning some other great tools and tactics that can help you to live your best life. We've got all of our podcasts up there. We've got new videos up every single day, and we've got some great articles up there as well. We've also got a lot of our training programs up there, ebooks on fitness that can help you to burn fat, build muscle, and increase your performance. We've also got some amazing supplements up there like Dynatropin. Dynatropin is a human growth hormone secretagogue that's been demonstrated in over 900 clinical cases to help you to increase your growth hormone levels by 50 to 200%. Really great things going on over at the Warrior Soul Goji. And if you want to check us out, again, that's www.warriorsoulagoge.com. I also wanted to ask you guys, if you can, to write us a review on iTunes. We put a lot of work into this podcast, and we want to know whether or not it's helping you out. So if you can, whether you like us or not, please be honest with us, but head over to iTunes and write us a review. It really helps this show out a lot. Today's podcast might cause you to question a lot of things. It's going to cause you to question what you've been eating, what you thought was healthy, and what causes various diseases. Over the past half century or more, we've looked at fat as an enemy in our nutrition. And we've neglected the role that carbohydrates and sugar may play in the onset of death-dealing disease. Our guest today is Mr. Gary Tobbs. He is the author of Good Calories, Bad Calories, and The Case Against Sugar. We get in a lot of different things, like the fact that one out of every four veterans admitted to the VA hospital system actually suffers from diabetes. That's a higher rate than the veteran suicide rate right now, and nobody's talking about it. So we get into this and even more as far as nutrition and the plague of diabetes and heart disease on our society here in the United States and in the Western world. And I think it's one of the most interesting conversations we've had. So without further delay, let's get into episode number 42 of the Warrior Soul Podcast with Mr. Gary Tobbs. This is Chris Albert, and I'm here to remind you of one thing. Someday, you're going to die. Now, that's not some morbid statement or scary idea. It's a solid fact. Your time here on this earth is limited. And you need to be reminded of this as much as possible for one simple reason. To live your best life while you can. This is the Warrior Soul Podcast. Good afternoon, everybody, or whatever time of day it is when you're listening to this podcast. This is Chris Albert here with my brother, Andrew Marr, and we're here today to talk about a very, very important issue, in our opinion, with not only with the veterans community, but with the country in general. Just some stats for you guys. 29.1 million people have diabetes. That's 9.3% of the population. 8.1 million people right now are undiagnosed. And one in four veterans admitted in the VA system have diabetes. I just got that. The first two statistics come from the CDC from 2014. And the last statistic comes from a book called The Case Against Sugar by a gentleman named Gary Tobbs, who's been a huge influence on me
and the way I conduct my diet through his books. The other major book that I read was Good Calories, Bad Calories. But we've got Gary here with us today. First, Gary, I just want to thank you so much for coming on to this podcast, and I want to thank you for your work, because I understand that, you know, going against the grain like this nutritionally, like you have, and just putting it out there, it can't be an easy thing.
It's interesting. I want to thank you guys for having me also, and I'm honored to do the podcast. Being a journalist, challenging the half century to a century of conventional thinking in nutrition is certainly an interesting position to be in life. I think maybe Don Quixote tilting at windmills is my role model.
Anytime you challenge that status quo, you meet resistance, you know, even when you can back it up with sound evidence. So I know you've seen that time and time again. What's propelled you to keep going forward, Gary, as you meet that resistance?
Well, it's folks like you. I mean, it's clearly so. We should establish what, you know, what that challenge is, and more or less how I got into it, because the world is full of quacks who challenge conventional wisdom and are wrong. And so, you know, I entered this field as a journalist in the mid-80s. I had a hard science background, and I was a science journalist doing investigative science reporting. So one thing I learned once I went into science journalism is just like there's the, you know, bad doctors and bad plumbers, and in the military you've got, you know, bad officers and bad enlisted men. People just can't do their job right, no matter all their best intentions. In science, you've got the same issue. And in the early 90s, I got into reporting on public health because the science there happened to be particularly bad. And that brought me into nutrition by the late 90s. And then I had the opportunity to spend 5 years of my life intensively researching the history of nutrition and the science of obesity and diabetes going back to the 19th century, which the internet made possible to do for the first time really comprehensively in a way that could never be done before. So the conclusions from this research was fascinating because, as you guys mentioned, we have these epidemics of diabetes that are unprecedented, and an epidemic of obesity that goes with it that's also unprecedented. And throughout this whole period, not only do the research community that studies these things think they completely understand the cause of these disorders, but the nutritional guidelines that we've been given to address it have been dominated by this idea that if you want to lose weight, you just got to eat less, and we should all be eating low-fat diets to prevent heart disease. And by eating low-fat diets, that'll also help us eat less, because fat is the densest calorie in the in the diet. Excuse me. So that's sort of the conventional wisdom. If you want to lose weight, you got to eat less, exercise more. And if you want to prevent heart disease, you got to eat low-fat diets, low-saturated fat diets particularly, so you avoid dairy and animal products. And when you go through the research, as I did, and you have the opportunity to do what I did, both these ideas turn out to just be more or less dead wrong. So the idea that you should just eat less to lose weight sounds about as obvious as any idea could be, but it's based on this idea that the way we get fat to begin with is just by taking in too many calories, and that ignores all these sort of hormonal regulatory issues that control how much fat we accumulate in our bodies and basically have very little to do with the caloric content of our diets and a lot to do with what we eat. So it's not how much we eat, it's what we eat. And then if you're concerned about what you eat, the problem becomes not the fat in your diet, but the kinds of carbohydrates we eat, the refined grains and sugars. So for the past 15 years or so, beginning with a legend, infamous New York Times Magazine cover story and then a series of books, I've been arguing, along with some very good researchers and an ever-growing number of physicians and nutritionists, that we should basically be doing the exact opposite of what the government has been telling us to do for the past 40 years.
That article was called "What If It Was All a Big Fat Lie?"
What if it's all been a big fat lie? Yeah, and I got pilloried for writing that.
What kind of resistance did you face? Because I've Googled your name quite a bit. I've listened to a lot of your interviews. I've mentioned you on a lot of my own YouTube videos because I run my own YouTube fitness channel as well. And there's some people out there, particularly, people in the vegan community and things like that. They just started spouting different types of vitriol and all kinds of things. What types of resistance have you faced from various communities, including the scientific community?
Well, so it comes in different forms. The scientific community in general tends to ignore you. When you challenge them, their response, and it's a valid response, is to, so the experts, the authorities, their response is, look, any journalist who comes along and says he knows better than we do is almost assuredly wrong, right? Because not only are we experts, all our friends and our allies and our colleagues and the people who have, given us promotions and given us grants and give us awards all think we're experts. They all think we know what we're doing. Clearly this journalist is wrong, so we don't even have to pay attention to him. That's one response. And then there are all the journalists who have been reporting this field for years. And if I'm right, then they've been wrong also. And everyone likes to think they do their job well. It's like human nature. I think I do it well. Somebody comes along and disagrees with me, my knee-jerk response is they're just not as bright as I am because clearly I know what I'm doing. So when a journalist comes along, and particularly in a very high-profile setting like the cover of the New York Times Magazine, and says not only did the research community get it wrong, but the journalists get it wrong, the journalists actually have an opportunity to very quickly respond because they write for newspapers and magazines. So I even had friends go after me. I had one woman in Boston who used to think I was one of the five best science health reporters in the country, maybe one of the three best, until I wrote a very high-profile article basically suggesting she had missed, implying she had missed the story, and then she wrote a piece implying that I had had a brain transplant or had sold out to the food industry or something, or had worse, had just made up the story so I could get a big book deal, which I did get a big book deal. So it was an easy target. So you get those kind of responses. There are organizations out there, consumer advocacy groups, who have been pushing for healthier diets for years, and what they've been pushing for are low-fat diets. So I'm challenging what they've been doing, and they also have the opportunity to respond in their newsletters. So my piece was called "What If It's All Been a Big Fat Lie?" The Center for Science and the Public Interest in Washington published an article claiming that I had basically made all numerous mistakes and misquoted people, and they called their article "Big Fat Lies," attacking me. So that's the kind of response. I was stunned by all this, by the way. I knew the piece would be very controversial because I was claiming that half century of nutrition research was almost assuredly wrong and doing it in this high profile venue, but I was still kind of stunned, as you put it, by the vitriol of the response, how people simply didn't want to hear it, and rather than deal with the message, the easiest thing to do is go after the messenger, which was me. After that, my job has been to sort of convince people that there's something valid here and they have to take it seriously. And again, every book I write is another attempt to do that. And, the feedback, what keeps me going is pretty simple, which is the world is full of people like you guys who have read the books, find them compelling, change their diet, and get healthier. And nowadays, there are probably, thousands of doctors who have changed the way they practice medicine based on these ideas. So I've had doctors say, you made medicine fun for me again because I can actually make my patients healthier instead of just prescribing them drugs to treat their symptoms. I can get them to shift their diet and actually watch them become healthy, and they can watch themselves become healthy. And the conventional wisdom is that nobody stays on a diet, and I would argue that's because it's the wrong diet and it's impossible to do and it doesn't make you healthier, you're not going to stick with it. But when you get the right diet and you change your diet correctly and you actually see these changes and feel these changes, people find it very compelling to stick with.
Gary, walk us through your mindset when you first started compiling your research and this data, some of the numbers that Chris read off earlier in the show. It must have been shocking, or you're like, my gosh, I found what I believe the reason to be all of our problems, and it's not being looked at. Like, what was that like for you when you first started coming to that conclusion?
Well, it's funny. I mean, even I didn't, you know, your thinking evolves as you go. So, and even writing books, I've often said that the process of writing a book is learning what book I should have written by the time I'm done. And it's not the book that you end up getting published. So when my first piece in the magazine, was the beginning of, in effect, this intensive research period. And then I spent 5 years researching and writing my first book, Good Calories, Bad Calories, which is a very sort of serious, almost academic work, despite the kind of diet bookish title. And that book is 500 pages long with 150-odd pages of endnotes and bibliography. And the learning experience there was, if you want people to understand how they could possibly have gotten a subject wrong. So I'm writing on one level to the experts, because the experts have to understand it. You know, the authorities have to understand it. The doctors have to get it. The scientists have to get it. The public health people have to get it. Otherwise, it's not going to be disseminated the way it has to be disseminated. So on some level, I'm writing to them, and they don't have the time to read a 500-page book, the subtext of which is you've been an idiot your whole life. I once gave a lecture at the Pennington Biomedical Research Center, which is in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and the title of the lecture is Why We Get Fat, and the implication is it's not about how many calories you eat, it's about the foods you eat and their effect on the hormones and enzymes that regulate fat accumulation. And at the end of the lecture, one of the faculty raised his hand and very politely said, Mr. Taubes, there's one subtext of your lecture that you think we're all idiots. And the answer is, oh, you know, I don't want to say yes. Kind of, that's the subtext. You have to figure out a polite way to explain why they could have missed a very simple story for 40 years and made a very kind of tragic, simple mistake for 40 years. So the first book was, yeah, people, it changed people's minds. It got some terrific reviews and some condescendingly dismissive reviews. But the lesson was, if I really want people to pay attention, I can't expect them to read 500 pages implying that they just are, you know, got everything wrong. So then I write the second book, Why We Get Fat, which is the kind of airplane reading version. And now I condense the history and the philosophy of science and all this kind of academic tome into this 250-page polemical argument. That book started to take off, and now, you know, a lot, it increased the readership and the understanding of the ideas significantly. But you're still not getting past the barrier of the research community, which is like, this is crap and we really don't have time. You know, it's just life is too short to bother reading this so that we could figure out why this journalist thinks we're wrong when clearly he's the one who's wrong. And then each book has gone, the last book, The Case Against Sugar, is a way to package the same ideas in an argument that in a form, to pardon the expression, a sugar-coated. So there's a lot of nutritionists who are going to read a book about the case against, called The Case Against Sugar, particularly because they know, they accept now that sugar is a huge problem, which they didn't 20 years ago when I first started this crusade. And so in the process of reading that book, I'm still, you know, hoping that they will absorb some of these other messages about how they might have misunderstood things. But it's still, I'm still constantly surprised by responses, and I still get very condescendingly dismissive reviews that I'm just a pop science writer and clearly I should leave the expertise to the experts. And I want to respond, you know, when you've got these unprecedented epidemics, you're the prevalence of diabetes in the U.S. has increased 700% in almost a little less than 60 years. I mean, that's almost unimaginable number. Why would you even consider trusting the experts with a number like that? Like, yes, clearly they're absolutely doing something wrong.
Yeah, it's ridiculous what's going on right now, and numbers are crazy. And you know, as somebody who's read Thomas Kuhn and studied scientific revolutions in the philosophy of science, I went through your book, Good Calories, Bad Calories, and that story about how fat got demonized, and about how we came to understand that, or came to believe that high carbohydrate diets were healthy. That was a fascinating story. Can you take us through a little bit of why this lipid hypothesis research program stays alive? Why does it stay alive? Why has it stayed alive for so long when it hasn't done any good?
Well, so this is, this is a part of the story that fascinates me. This is what obsessed the investigative journalist in me. So one of my favorite lines, which I quote in multiple books, is by the Nobel laureate physicist Richard Feynman, who said, "The first principle of science is you must not fool yourself, and you're the easiest person to fool." And so the best scientists in the world are hypercritical of their own ideas, or skeptical, and they believe this idea that what you're trying to do in science is prove that you got it wrong. So you get a hypothesis, and then you try to disprove the hypothesis, and you try as hard as you can to disprove the hypothesis. And when you fail to successfully disprove it, you get your friends and colleagues involved in trying to disprove it, and eventually you begrudgingly say, "Look, this hypothesis might be right because we have completely failed to shoot it down. And we're going to believe it until somebody else can show us how we screwed up." That's kind of how science works and how it should work. So nutrition, what happens is post-World War II, you get this awareness that there's appears to be a heart disease epidemic going on in the world. That middle-aged executives are dropping dead from heart attacks, and whether or not there was an epidemic is a longer story, but there's the appearance of epidemics. So nutritionists in the U.S. decide they're going to try and figure this out. And because heart attacks are linked to atherosclerosis, you know, plaques in your arteries, and the plaques in your arteries have cholesterol in them, the idea is whatever raises cholesterol might cause atherosclerosis, and lo and behold, fats from animal products, they don't think of them as saturated fats yet, but these animal fats raise cholesterol. So one particular nutritionist named Ansel Keys, who's a very smart guy in some ways, not so smart in others, and very influential already in the 50s, decides that dietary fat's the cause of heart disease based on some simple observations and some very simplistic thinking. And then he goes about trying to convince the world that he's right, and trying to convince himself that he's right. And because there's no competing hypothesis in the 1960s, so they don't have any real belief system about what the dietary cause of heart disease is, Keyes gets this idea that it's dietary fat, and that just fills this vacuum. So suddenly the idea is dietary fat probably causes heart disease. We're going to do all these studies and all these tests to prove that that hypothesis is right, not test the hypothesis, which is what they're supposed to be doing, but to prove it's right. And until then, we're going to believe it's right, and eventually we'll prove it. So complete kind of ass-backwards way of doing science. And these people, frankly, were never trained to be scientists. They were trained to be doctors, and they weren't first-rate intellects. They were second- and third-rate intellects, the kind of people who went into nutrition in the 60s were, rather than physics or molecular biology or Wall Street or even medicine. And what's interesting is the more studies they did study after study, and they kept failing to confirm this idea that dietary fat causes heart disease, but they just kept looking for reasons to rationalize why the study failed. So you could always find in a study a little piece of data that supports your belief and ignore all the negative data. And that's basically what they did. Technically called cherry picking. Everyone does it to some extent. They kind of perfected it. And as these studies went on, and then the National Institutes of Health gets involved, and they're decide they're going to fund $250 million worth of studies. This is now the mid-1970s. And Congress agrees to let them spend $250 million. And from the standpoint of a congressman, if you're going to fund a study testing the hypothesis that dietary fat causes heart disease, the only successful conclusion to that test is to confirm that it does. So that to a congressman, if that study refutes the hypothesis, it's a waste of money. To a scientist, that's successful science. To a congressman, it's a waste of money. So you end up with this sort of huge kind of societal movement. The journalists get involved, and they ask people like Ansel Keys, you know, what causes heart disease? And he says, well, dietary fat does. So the journalists are writing that dietary fat causes heart disease. The congressmen believe it causes heart disease. A congressional committee decides for the first time ever to put together dietary guidelines for America, and they have, in effect, one writer with a background in labor reporting from a Rhode Island newspaper interview four scientists who say, oh, yeah, dietary fat causes heart disease. And you just get this kind of what's technically called a cascade effect. And the studies continue to refute the hypothesis until finally 1984, coincidentally, one huge study, one of the two studies done, which was testing the hypothesis that a cholesterol-lowering drug could reduce heart disease and make people live longer, seems to be a success in that it seems to show that men live longer on this cholesterol-lowering drug. And the National Institutes of Health and all these health organizations just sort of dive in and decide they are going to tell all Americans that we have to go on low-fat diets based on a drug study, not even a diet study. And again, as you go through, even as I'm telling this story, I'm thinking, this sounds impossible. Surely this didn't happen. And yet this is, you know, it's an abbreviated version of what happened over a 20-year period. By the mid-1980s, we were being bombarded from numerous government agencies and publications with this message that we should all eat low-fat diets. And it was simply wrong. And it was an interesting hypothesis that could never be confirmed. And then once the government was invested, the American Heart Association actually had been invested in this idea since the early 1960s, they're just not going back. It's very hard for a government organization to acknowledge that they made a mistake. You know, you can't imagine the American Heart Association putting together a press release, for instance, explaining why the low-fat diet advice they'd been given since 1961 was wrong and apologizing for killing any people they might have killed. And it's just never going to happen. So, you know, the organizations get more and more dug in, and you end up with an idea that is extremely difficult to remove from the sort of population thinking zeitgeist.
Well, let's talk about the impact there. What was the impact of this faulty research program, and how did it affect the average person here in the United States?
Well, so here's the idea. When you tell people to eat less fat, you have to replace those calories with something. So the question is, what do you replace it with? And the answer was carbohydrates. I don't know if you guys remember the food guide pyramid, but the base of the food guide pyramid, this came in the mid-90s, was, you know, pasta, bread, potatoes, rice. So one shift is, and I document this in my books, from the early 1800s to the mid-1960s, the conventional thinking was that carbohydrates were fattening. You know, bread, pasta, potatoes, beer, sweets, and literally make you fat. Nobody really quite understood why, what it meant. You know, does it make you eat more? Does it make you just accumulate more fat? But the conventional wisdom was that if you don't want to get fat, those are the foods you didn't eat. Now, beginning in the 1960s, we start telling people to eat low-fat diets, and then we institutionalize this in the 1980s. So you eat less fat and you replace it with carbs, fattening carbs. And the carbohydrate itself goes from being thought of as uniquely fattening in the 1960s to a heart-healthy diet food by the 1980s. So I remember being a young journalist in New York when suddenly everybody started eating baked potatoes for dinner every night, and the idea was a baked potato was a healthy diet food. You just didn't put butter or sour cream on it, which were the fattening things. So we literally shifted our diets from, you know, a higher fat diets to lower fat, higher carbs, and we started eating these foods that previous generations, just based on their copious anecdotal experience, thought were fattening. And then the other thing that happened is sugar, which includes, you know, the cane and beet sugar, the white stuff you put in your coffee or sprinkle on your cereal, which is technically sucrose, and then high fructose corn syrup, which is a syrupy version of sugar that came in the late 1970s and is made from corn. These were kind of given a free pass. So there was also this conventional thinking that sugar was something you should avoid in a healthy diet. But once we targeted fat as the problem, and then the food industry was instructed, for instance, by the Centers for Disease Control to come out with low-fat food products, they would remove the fat from the product, and then you've got this sort of tasteless, insipid food. And so you have to replace those calories again, and you replace it with sugar, high fructose corn syrup, and then you can market it as heart healthy diet food. So yogurt is the classic example of this, and you end up with this whole world, tens of thousands of low fat food substances being produced and marketed that are lower in fat, equal calories, and higher in sugar, and are now being portrayed as health foods. And even sugary beverages, sodas, things like that were just assumed to be benign because fat was the problem, not sugar. So the country goes on this prolonged sugar binge and this carb binge, and all of us thinking we're eating healthy the way we're being told to eat. And you could see this reflected in the statistics from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And simultaneously, obesity and diabetes rates skyrocket. And, you know, again, you can't say that's the cause, but it's very suspicious. So, you know, my guess is a lot of these, even the vets, one in four vets with diabetes in the VA medical system are diabetic in large part because thinking they've been eating a healthy diet and yet simply eating the wrong foods.
Yeah, I mean, I think back to when we when I was in, and I was just actually looking over the nutrition factors in MREs, the meals ready to eat, you know, I'll just pull some up for you over here. The Chili Mac, which was actually my favorite MRE during that whole time, it had something like 160 grams of total carbohydrate with 100 grams of sugar in a single meal. You know, just going down the list, the average is like, I mean, the lowest I've seen is 47 grams of sugar in a single meal. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Well, it's funny because one of the big controversies in the 1960s, so there was a school of British nutritionists who were saying, hey, the problem is white flour and sugar and refined carbohydrates. That includes like the maltose in beer, but mostly white flour and sugar. And this guy, Ansel Keys, who thought it was fat, and Keys was the kind of guy that you would describe as not suffering fools gladly, which is to me another word for, I don't know if I could, what kind of language you're allowed to use on your show, but so I won't go.
Use whatever language you want, man. Anything you want.
So it's another word for an asshole, basically. Anyway, Keyes, the guy pushing the sugar school in the UK, said sugar is a problem, is a guy named John Yudkin, who happened to be the premier nutritionist in Europe. He was, you know, one of the smartest nutritionists out there. He had the best science training. And he was criticizing Keyes' work, and Keyes hated him, and he didn't like Keyes. And what's interesting, so Keyes back in World War II was famous for a series of things, including creating the K ration. And the K was said to stand for Keyes. And the K ration is loaded with sugar, including their sugar tablets in it. So the idea is, you know, you load people up with sugar and that gives them energy. And then Key's laboratory was also funded by the sugar industry, which may or may not have played a role. But I often wondered if the reason that Key's was so adamant against this idea that sugar was a problem was in part because he had been played a major role in basically, you know, infusing generations of U.S. military men with high sugar diets. But the idea is ultimately that, you know, it's the sugar and the carbs that cause the diabetes. This is the argument I'm making in the case against sugar. And so you need clearly genetic factors are involved with this disease, but it's ultimately and fundamentally the sugar in the diet that causes it. Maybe not even in your diet, but in your mother's diet, because she can sort of pass on a susceptibility to this disease in the womb. So it's a very, the science is fascinating, and it's basic. I mean, it's all pretty much conventional biology that's just been ignored for 50 years, because once we started getting this story wrong, the researchers can't believe that, you know, they became invested in it, and their egos and their careers and their belief in their own, you know, capabilities became invested in it.
I just want to get Andrew's perspective on this, because I did a post a couple of weeks ago just talking about the amount of sugar in MREs. And, you know, there's guys out there, and they even say it on the box. They say war fighters have unique nutrition requirements, and that's kind of how they justify the sugar content. But, you know, I had some people come on to the post, and they were like, well, we need the sugar when we're out there doing infantry stuff and everything. And Andrew, you know, you're a Green Beret. You operated for quite a while, did three tours in Afghanistan. What's your perspective on all this as far as nutrition in the field?
Well, I think what Gary's helping to kind of illuminate through his books and the new understanding with the science is establishing with inflammation. We didn't realize as far as people operating on a whole, what role inflammation actually could play as being detrimental to our health, and what role nutrition could play in either being pro-inflammatory or anti-inflammatory. So when you think of it in that aspect, something that's high in sugar or high in refined or processed sugar or carbohydrates are going to lead to what we call a non-neuropermissive environment, something that's where the body could be riddled with chronic inflammation, especially if you're eating like this over and over and over again. So then being around or in environments that you're with low level explosions and, you know, things that were the heads repetitively getting jarred, you're susceptible to brain injury and other things. So I think if there's a direct correlation there that we're helping to show. But I think anybody who has a problem, you know, they talk negatively about eating sugar in the field, they don't have an understanding what they're really trying to do. A professional would never talk that way. So when new science comes out, you know, what are the Olympians doing? How are they preparing? And we will try to do the same thing in special forces. That's why I love Gary's book and the information so much, because I know it's getting implemented there, because they're taking that information and saying, oh, shit, man, how can we change what we're doing to benefit, you know, and achieve the mission? So if you know that sugar is going to deplete the system, it's going to be a quick energy, and then you're going to need it again, you're going to fall off, this doesn't provide benefits. And if you're really focused on accomplishing a mission, then you shouldn't be worrying about comfort foods. You should be wanting to fuel your body with the most optimal sources possible in order to achieve that mission. So, you know, I guess that's what our thinking is on it there.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because you've got sort of different time scales going on here as well, and different, there's sort of short and long-term goals with when you're talking about ideal nutrition. And one of the things I learned doing the research for the Sugar book is you go back to the 1910s, 1920s, athletic coaches thought of sugar as performance-enhancing drug. So there are these studies where they're actually feeding sugar to marathoners and to rowers, crew. And the Germans were actually perfecting the use of sugar in the military, and they thought this is terrific for, because it is quick energy, and we all know, I mean, mix it with caffeine, and it's you know, a pretty unique stable high for 3 or 4 hours, and you could get, if you just think of it as performance-enhancing drug, it's not surprising that people would feel that it's absolutely necessary for enhanced military performance, and particularly when you're out in the field, you think of the K-rations or MREs. You need food that's easily preserved, that you could take with you, that's, you know, small packages, that isn't going to spoil. It's not a question of, you know, cooking a lot of vegetables when you're out there. So sugar can be an extraordinarily valuable part of the diet, but just like any other performance-enhancing drug, it could you be doing long-term harm. And then when you're in susceptible to injury and from explosions, and you could imagine that the conditions, as you talked about, Andrew, the inflammation in the body could actually make the effects of those wounds worse. But you don't know for sure. You don't really know that. And the only way you could find out would be through some pretty significant research. What you do know is I can feed soldiers up with sugar just like I could feed, you know, a marathoner with sugar. And for 2 hours, he or she might perform better than if they don't have sugar. And again, it's certainly easy to transport and to take with us and to make sure the soldier's always going to have enough food. But that's a separate issue from then the long-term effects. And a third issue here is in this whole world, you know, what I've been arguing and others is that the carbohydrate content of the diet is the problem. And if you're, again, predisposed to be obese or diabetic, or you're already there, you should be eating very low-carb, high-fat diets. You have to trust that that fat isn't giving you heart disease. And then the extreme version of that is what's called a ketogenic diet, where you've got very low carbs, very high fat. Your liver is producing ketones, which is feeding your brain and your organs. And there's a lot of evidence that people work exceedingly efficiently when they're in ketosis, and that it can also enhance performance significantly without the downsides of sugar. But now you've got to be able to take foods with you to the war zone that are, you know, keto friendly, and they're hard to package the way they, I mean, nowadays people are creating these foods and they're creating artificial ketones. So you can do it. And I know that the DOD is doing research in this and funding some of this research. But up until the last 5 or 10 years, the idea of being in ketosis in a war zone would be virtually impossible. You just couldn't do it. You wouldn't have the foods available to do it. Unless you were hunting yourself.
We actually just came back from Paleo FX, and you know, we were looking, there's some amazing advancements being done to the point where I think that eventually we'll be able to have an MRE that could be able to help guys get into ketosis. But one thing I think significant is that, you know, back when I was eating these MREs, when I was on that sort of diet, you know, I'd be eating things like pound cake to try to keep my energy up, just as you say. And in about an hour or two afterwards, I was literally brain dead, you know, trying to rub chewing tobacco into my eyes to try to keep myself awake because of the brain fog.
Did that work?
it did. I mean, that's partially the reason why I think I developed a tobacco habit when I was in the military, was because I was just constantly trying to keep myself alert. And just hearing from I know Andrew, were you guys using like intermittent fasting or anything like that prior to missions, or were you consuming anything else prior to missions to try to stay alert there?
No, we were using intermittent fasting, but that had just, it's 2010, 2011, we just started implementing that or understanding that, but it wasn't like, as a whole, and no idea, like Gary was talking about ketosis or producing ketones, had no idea that that was even a thing there.
Well, and this is what, it's an interesting debate that goes back into the 1930s, 1940s. So even back then, I think it was I forget if it was the U.S. government or the Canadian government, financed a study to see how soldiers performed in ketosis, because one of the arguments for it is that the Native Americans, basically lived on zero carb, high fat diets for at least 6 months out of the year through the winter. And the explorers that explored the U.S. 300 years ago were living on a food called pemmican, which is made primarily from buffalo fat. And all these people would have been, in effect, in ketosis much of the year. So the Canadian government did a study of soldiers, but it takes time to become what's called keto-adapted, where your body transitions from burning carbohydrates, which it's burning if you're eating a typical American diet, to burning fat and ketones, which is what it burns if once you transition. It takes about 3 weeks to make that keto adaption adaptation successfully. And this study done in Canada was done on soldiers over the course of 3 days without allowing them to keto adapt. And they said, look, these guys are just exhausted. They can barely carry their packs for an hour, let alone do a day's worth of hiking. So that was the end of those studies. But the other investigators, particularly those, for instance, that had lived in the Arctic with the Inuit, said, once people become keto-adapted, they could do amazing feats of endurance. There was a famous Harvard anthropologist who lived with the Inuit for a decade in the 1910s who would describe, he said they would go on a dog sled treks through the snow, and the Inuit would run alongside for 25 miles, running alongside the dog sleds without needing to rest because they were living on, fat and protein and no carbohydrates. And he said once the explorers got keto adapted, once they got used to that diet, they could do these kind of remarkable feats of endurance. But it requires that adaptation period. And it's hard to stay in ketosis when you live in a world where all the foods, basically the only foods available are carb rich or not sufficiently fat rich.
Gary, can you talk about how we transitioned over the last few hundred years from, there being no sugar in the diet or not nearly as much as there is today per capita, and, there diabetes was virtually unknown in certain parts of the world and only seen in the wealthy in other parts, as opposed to where we are today. So what's changed and why has it changed?
Well, so that's the case that I'm making, the case against sugar, is I'm trying to explain this as worldwide phenomenon, which is the appearance of obesity and diabetes epidemics whenever a population transitions from whatever its traditional diet is to a Western diet. And in the U.S., this happened with the Industrial Revolution that started in the late 17th century. So this transition builds slowly through the 19th century, and then in the 20th century, it sort of comes to blossom. And as this happened, you see diabetes prevalence, and I documented this from hospital records from the 19th century. You see diabetes going from a vanishingly rare disease, like major urban hospitals will have zero patients. Remember, we said one in four vets in the VA medical system is diabetic. Major urban hospitals like Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston or Pennsylvania Hospital in Philadelphia in the mid-19th century had zero. They had many years where they had zero cases of diabetes, which before the discovery of insulin was a horrible, debilitating, fatal disease with you know, manifestations that were pretty easy to diagnose because they were so awful, including, you know, blindness and infections leading to gangrene and, you know, the need for amputation. So you'd expect these people to show up in hospitals, and it just wasn't happening. And as post-Civil War in the U.S., you see the number of diabetics in the hospital year-to-year increase. And the, basically, the epidemic that we've been experiencing, you could see its origins, you know, right in post-Civil War era, where, you know, suddenly diabetes is beginning to appear in the population. You look at sugar consumption over this period specifically, and it increases by a factor, I forget if it was 4 or 8 in the 19th century. Basically, you think of all the ways we eat sugar today, and they, except for sugar, you know, in our coffee and your cereal, granulated sugar, they just didn't exist at the beginning of the 19th century. So the candy industry, the ice cream industry, the chocolate industry, they all are founded in like the 1840s, 1850s with the mass production of these products, and they start to be shipped. For the first time in history, children and women are kind of being targeted as the consumers of sugar. As the price is coming down, all these items appear, and then in the 1870s, 1880s, soft drinks appear. And, you know, Coke and Pepsi and Dr. Pepper, and they just saturate the world. So by the early 20th century, you know, there's this massive soft drink industry, and it's becoming part of the diet. It's just the natural thing that everyone consumes, which they didn't consume 50 years earlier. Post-World War I, by the 1930s, the fruit juice industry kicks up. And if you think about it, you can't really drink sodas and fruit juices in the home until you have refrigerators and freezers in the home. And it's not till the 1930s that refrigerators and freezers become cheap enough that they become sort of common appliances in everyone's home. And with them, Coke and Pepsi and these other companies start producing. Now you start getting six packs of sodas and large cartons of sodas so people could take it home and keep it cold in their refrigerator. And then there's a break for the war period where basically the U.S. government does the job of making sure every soldier has plenty of sugar. And actually Coca-Cola and PepsiCo both have these programs work to make sure that the soldiers could get as much Coke and as much Pepsi as they want, as cheaply as they want. And it's seen as, you know, doing their patriotic duty for the country, which they, I'm sure that's how they thought, but it's simultaneously sort of infecting, you know, creating this massive sugar addiction in an entire generation of young American men, or young men all over the world.
Great business model to expand, you know, globally, right?
Well, this is, and while they're doing this, they're also, particularly Coca-Cola, is using the war as an opportunity to build bottling plants everywhere in the world. In part, in post-war in Europe, they use, and in the South Pacific, they use, you know, German and Japanese prisoners of war to help build the bottling plant. So, yeah, they see it as a concerted effort to spread the reach of Coca-Cola around the world to make it the ubiquitous product that it is today. I think Coca-Cola is the second most recognized word in the world after okay. Anyways, this happens post-World War II. You then 1950s, you get this explosion in sugary cereals. So back at the turn of the 20th century, when cereal manufacturers thought about putting cereal and sugar, putting sugar in cereal, they didn't do it because the cereal industry had come out of the health food industry. And these are all, you know, the idea was you eat a lot of fiber and it helps with constipation. And if you could take care of constipation, people live to be 100. So the cereal industries were very resistant about putting sugar in their products. But by the 1950s, one company sort of took the step post with Sugar Crisp, and everyone else thought, boy, if we don't dump sugar in our products, you know, we're going to be run out of the business. So by the 1960s, you've got this sort of perfect storm where particularly children, from the moment they wake up to the moment they go to sleep, they're being loaded with sugar. So this, the amount of sugar they would have gotten in 1800 in a week, they're now getting basically every 3 hours through the course of the day. And this becomes the norm.
I found it funny because, you know, reading your book, they took the cocaine out of Coca-Cola, and you would think that, you know, cocaine being an addictive substance, the sales would go down, but they went up exponentially. You know, how addictive is sugar?
Well, this is, you know, it's another subject that is very poorly studied. From the 1970s onward, once this guy Ansel Keys successfully, Ansel Keys in the sugar industry, successfully convinced the research community and Americans in general that this sugar is bad hypothesis was quackery, you couldn't study it. So the NIH didn't spend, nobody was out there. There was one research group that was out there looking, studying whether or not sugar might be addictive in some way. So we know it affects the same part of the brain that other addictive substances do. That's called the nucleus accumbens. We know that at least for laboratory rats and mice, it's more addictive than cocaine or heroin. So by that, you could addict a rat to cocaine and give it a daily bolus of Coke, and then give it an opportunity to have either sugar water or the Coke, and it'll switch to the sugar water. And the same is true of heroin, although it'll take a little bit longer to decide to go for the sugar water over the heroin. But we're not rats, so you don't know for sure that it... as far as I'm concerned, if you have children, you don't need a lot of hard science to know that there's something powerful about sugar that isn't true of any other food. You know, we don't have to ration other. I don't have to tell my kids to stop eating even the most expensive steak on the market. I don't have to ration that. You always have to ration sugar. There's something about it that triggers a craving that other foods don't trigger. And we just... like I said, by the 1960s, it had become okay for basically every meal to be some kind of minor variation on dessert. Even to the point that I remember spending a few weeks in Utah writing my second book back in the mid-80s, and the wonderful family I was staying with was feeding, it was strawberry-flavored sugar-sweetened linguine for dinner. You know, the kind of crazy acceptance of this substance as the norm. And to say anything about it was to be a food faddist. So until very recently, the last 5 to 10 years, if you said anything negative about sugar, you were like the Grinch trying to steal Christmas. Now, finally, like I said, the nutrition community's got on board, and they're all saying, well, we always said sugar was bad. So they don't have to say we missed the boat, But it in this 40 to 50 year period, we hit levels of sugar consumption that were unprecedented by any society. 150 pounds of sugar per year was being delivered by the sugar industry and the corn refiners to, you know, for every American in the country. Like crazy amounts.
Gary, I'm interested in your research methods and techniques. I know you say over 5 years very intensely, and the internet gave you opportunities that we never had before. But how did your research techniques develop? Did you start out with a whiteboard and you have like 1,000 questions, and then how do you compile it? I find that fascinating. Can you speak a little bit towards that?
Yeah, and that kind of evolves naturally. So once I started doing I had two ways to address this. As a journalist, you know, my first book, I lived at the physics laboratory, CERN. So this is, CERN is this huge European lab outside of Geneva where they have, at the moment, the world's largest particle accelerator. And I had gone there in 1984-85 to follow what I thought was going to be a great discovery in physics. So in today's lingo, I was embedded with the physicists thinking I was going to write a book about this great discovery. And what I learned when I got there was a researcher who actually won the Nobel Prize while I was there, was the head of the experiment. While he was going around the world telling people about this great discovery they were on to, once I arrived at the laboratory, I realized that there were people in his own experiment who thought the discovery was wrong, who basically thought they were fooling themselves. And they thought they were fooling themselves because they had built the equipment with their bare hands and they knew how that equipment could fool them. Whereas this soon-to-be Nobel laureate, they hadn't built a piece of equipment in 40 years. He just assumed that if it was telling him there was a great discovery, he was going to go run with it. So I had come out of that experience realizing that if you wanted to learn the truth about a piece of science, you couldn't just talk to the head of the experiment and it's called the principal investigators. You had to try and talk to everyone, even the technicians, you know, the guys whose names don't even show up in the paper because it's the technicians who are going to build the experiments who really understand how this devices can fool you. And I can assume there's, if I wanted to report about a major issue in the military, I would want to do the same thing. I'm not just going to listen to the generals. I want to talk to everyone. So I had developed this sort of saturation reporting style where I wanted to talk to everyone involved. And that was prior to even getting into public health and nutrition. My second book, which was about this scientific fiasco called cold fusion that happened in the late 80s, I interviewed over 300 researchers and administrators and graduate students and bureaucrats and technicians for what may have been the stupidest scientific subject in the 20th century. Then when I got into the nutrition world, beginning with an article for the journal Science in the late 90s on whether or not salt causes high blood pressure, what you found is in these controversial subjects, there's a period in time in which the sort of paradigm is set, the conventional wisdom is set. And just before that happens, the people who are pushing one side of the argument and the people who are pushing the other side of the arguments are giving their best arguments. So they're writing their papers where they're referencing all the key discoveries, everything they think is vital to making their argument. And you could get those papers and then go back in time through the references, basically to see if what they're arguing is supported by the evidence they're supplying. And you could imagine it's very similar to what competing teams of lawyers do in a criminal case. And it's just like a lawyer would tell the private investigator that they hire, you want to make sure you go through, you know, run down every piece of evidence, see if it really says what they say it says, see if there are alternative explanations. So beginning with salt and then moving on to the issue of dietary fat, I just sort of developed this method where I went back in time through the literature in a very comprehensive manner. And as I went back in time, I also wanted to talk to everyone who, if they were still alive, who had published the studies. And the people whose, you know, in some cases, every single name on the paper, to see if the interpretation that was in the paper was the, you know, if everyone agreed with the interpretation. And it was an endless process. And then when I got into, you know, obesity specifically, you know, the papers went back to the 19th century. And like I said, the internet and the books went back so you could recreate the history of obesity research by, you know, one of the things I could do that no one before me could do, I could literally go online and find every relevant book on the subject and then find a place where I could buy it from. You know, booksellers now had their catalogs online. Nowadays, it's all on Google Books. You don't even have to buy them. But when I was doing this research, I ended up collecting probably one of the best private libraries on obesity books going back to the 19th century. So I could see what people thought, when they thought it, what the evidence was, what the counterarguments were, you know, and basically build it forward and then see how the conventional wisdom, when it won. So this belief that obesity is caused just by eating too much, and that there is no kind of hormonal regulatory factors driving our predisposition to get obese was an idea that was being discredited by the late 1930s, but then World War II comes along, and the people who were refuting that idea were all Germans and Austrians, and they just vanish with the war. And so you can actually see this happen in the literature, how the bedrock belief about obesity, that it's caused by taking in more than calories than we expend, was an idea that these brilliant European clinicians thought was intellectually bankrupt. And they were arguing that it was intellectually bankrupt, but then the war disrupts that school. Afterwards, nobody wants anything to do with German and Austrian clinicians. And this very simplistic, naive idea about the cause of obesity ends up carrying the day because the critics vanished. So this is the kind of thing you could do when you take a historical perspective.
That's absolutely fascinating to think, you know, what implications the war had on biasing our opinion or not even being open to listening to other viewpoints. Can you talk about the role of insulin and insulin resistance and how that plays a big factor in this, Gary?
Okay, so that's the, you know, getting back to this sort of pre-World War II European idea. So there was this one very prompt, you have to think, understand that when we talk about obesity research like pre-World War II, you're talking about five people in the world who studied it and wrote about it in any significant way, maybe 10 maximum. And so you've got these German and Austrian clinicians in this school of research that they had found that all the fields of medicine relevant to obesity, metabolism, nutrition, endocrinology, the study of hormones, genetics, these things are barely understood in America. I mean, it's just a fact of life. American doctors and researchers were backward when it came to subjects like genetics and endocrinology because it had been founded in Europe. And in fact, if you wanted to do meaningful research back then, you had to at least be able to read German. So you could read the German language literature, the German, which was this, German was the lingua franca of medical science pre-World War II. So these guys come to the conclusion that obesity has to be a hormonal regulatory disorder. You know, the fact that simple observations, too, like men and women fatten differently. So men get fat above the waist, women get fat below the waist. That tells you that sex hormones are involved in where we get fat. And if involved in where we get fat, they're probably involved in why we get fat. You know, boys and girls, when they go through puberty, boys lose fat and gain muscle. Girls gain fat and they gain it in very specific places. And that tells you again that this is, you know, the accumulation of fat is being determined by hormones, not whether or not they're taking in more calories than they expend. So then this school vanishes. And it's not until the 1960 specifically, that research technology is invented that allows researchers to measure hormone levels in the bloodstream accurately. And this is the field of endocrinology, of the study of hormones, explodes in the 1960s. Finally, you can measure hormones accurately and you know what you're doing. And by mid-1960s, it's absolutely clear that the hormone insulin regulates, for all intents and purposes, determines how much fat you're going to store in your fat cells. So you raise insulin, you store fat, you lower insulin, you mobilize the fat that you've stored and you burn it for fuel. And insulin's the primary hormone determining this. And then there's this condition that's come to be understood also in the early 1960s called insulin resistance, which is where your cells are resistant to the hormone insulin. So when you eat carbohydrates particularly, your pancreas secretes insulin, and as the carbohydrates get into your bloodstream as glucose and raise blood sugar, the insulin helps your cells take up the blood sugar, the glucose, and use it for fuel. So the insulin tells your fat cells to store fat, and it tells your lean tissue basically to burn carbs because you want to keep that blood sugar under control. Too much blood sugar is toxic, and the insulin is basically orchestrating that use of fuels. Researchers realized, actually the same researchers who invented this technology for measuring hormone levels very quickly realized that type 2 diabetes, the common form that associates with obesity, isn't a disorder of insulin deficiency, which type 1 is, the kind that's so awful that comes in childhood, but it's a disorder of insulin resistance, that these obese diabetics have too much insulin in their bloodstream rather than not enough. And the same thing is true of obese people. They they tend to be insulin resistant, meaning they need to secrete more insulin to do their job. So by 1965, and this is kind of amusing in a horrible way, it's clear that insulin regulates fat accumulation, and that if you want to lower fat accumulation, you got to lower insulin. And it's clear that obese and type 2 diabetics have too much insulin in their bloodstream, which would work to make them fatter. And again, the people who invented this technology, this woman, Rosalind Yalow, would later win the Nobel Prize for it, are arguing that it seems quite likely that insulin and insulin resistance actually cause obesity. So you just become a little insulin resistant, you have to secrete a little too much insulin, and that makes you store fat instead of burning it. And you only have to store 20 extra calories a day as fat to gain 20 pounds of fat every 10 years. So it's a very little slight effect that would very easily make people obese. And, you know, our obesity research community is convinced that fat is the problem with modern diets, and that fat people just eat too much. And a lot of the obesity research in the U.S. is being driven by psychologists who are trying to get fat people to just eat less. So this whole science of how insulin and insulin resistance relate to fat accumulation, obesity, and type 2 diabetes is just considered irrelevant, because the implication of that research is that carbohydrates are fattening, because we secrete insulin in response to carbohydrates, and that sugar in particular is bad because that's likely to be the cause of insulin resistance. So this research community, convinced as they are that, you know, they're so focused on fat, and they're so convinced that obese people are just, they're gluttons and sloth, and it's just all about overeating, that they just take this very beautiful human physiology, that all of which implicates the carbohydrate content of the diet, and they kind of sweep it out of sight because it's inconvenient. And we end up with the conventional thinking. And worse than that, we end up with this belief that if you were to design a diet to lower insulin and maximize basically to get as much fat out of your fat tissue as you could, that would be a diet that is very low in carbs and very high in fat. In fact, it's the Atkins diet for all intents and purposes. And these guys insisted that that was quackery. So not only did they take this physiology, which is now textbook physiology, and say it's irrelevant to obesity, but then they took the diets that were based on human physiology and were the, you know, ideal diets to reverse this very terrible disorder, and they insisted that that was quackery that would kill people without the data to back it up.
Yeah. You know, it seems like somewhere in the story, you know, it seems like the powers that be were trying to come up with sound bites that they could translate diet advice to. And one of the examples I see in your story is that of energy balance and the concept of calories, calorie counting. And, you know, when I first got in the fitness industry, I was working for a corporate gym that shall remain nameless. And, you know, when I was talking about diet advice, the fitness manager would pull me aside and she would say, the only thing that we can talk about, because it's the only science that we have to go off of, is that if they want to get leaner, they have to consume less calories. But looking at things and knowing what I know now, it seems like this concept of calories creates kind of a black box for them to kind of sweep stuff under the rug. Could you speak a little bit about why calories became relevant and how has it masked a lot of these issues that you talk about in your books?
You know, I can't, although clearly speaking a little bit about any subject is something I have trouble with. I got to give you the history again. Fascinating. This is what fascinates me about this work, and this is why I became so obsessive. So modern nutrition science begins in the late 1860s in Germany with the invention of something, devices called calorimeters that allow researchers to measure the energy expended by, like, dogs or human subjects. So you basically live in this box, and the box measures the oxygen you're taking in, the carbon dioxide you're taking out, and from that you could figure out how much energy you're expending, how many calories you're expending. And we know that 100 years previous to that, the French physiologists had figured out how to burn foods and calorimeters to figure out how many calories are in the food. So beginning with the 1860s, you could measure the calories people eat and the calories people expend, and that's all they could measure. And then, so for the next 50 years, all of nutrition science is basically studying calories in and calories out in a whole bunch of different settings, and, like, you know, in children and soldiers and hospital beds. And they could also study vitamin deficiencies, so, and mineral deficiencies. So that's what nutrition science is. And by the 1920s, 1910s, you have this theory that obesity is caused by taking in more calories than we spend, because that's all they could measure. There's a story in science that's very relevant called the drunk in the streetlight story. I first heard this when I was writing about physics, because the physicists used to use it all the time. And I'm always surprised that other people don't know it. The idea is a guy's walking down the street, and he comes upon a drunk. It's at nighttime, and he comes upon a drunk on his knees under a streetlight, crawling around on the ground. And he asks the drunk what he's doing, and the guy, drunk, says, "I'm looking for my keys." And the guy says, "Is this where you lost them?" And the drunk says, "I don't know where I lost them, but this is where the light is." And yeah, in nutrition research in 1900, 1910, the light was on calories. So they come up with this idea that obesity is caused by taking in more calories. They know nothing about hormones. And the whole science of endocrinology starts to kick up in 1922 with the discovery of insulin. But the people studying obesity, talking about it, they know nothing. All they're focused on is energy. So we have this theory that it's just about calories in, calories out, because that's what they can measure. And as it turns out, the different macronutrients in the diet, proteins, carbohydrates, and fats, have very dramatically different effects on hormonal status. And hormones determine things like how much fat we're going to accumulate, or how much fat we're going to burn for food, fuel, whether we're going to store things, how much protein we're going to use to build muscles. That's all determined by hormones. But by the time, like I said, 1960, when hormones can be measured accurately in the bloodstream and they can become aware of insulin resistance and the role of insulin in fat accumulation, this idea that obesity is just simple, it's calories in, calories out, fat people eat too much and they exercise too little, they're gluttons and they're sloths, it's got this nice biblical ring to it, it just seems obvious. And it, again, it just becomes set like a stone. I mean, I recently got a condescendingly dismissive review by a Harvard professor in The New Yorker, and his professor writes, you know, the importance of calories, you know, you get fat when you eat more than you expend, is the unchallengeable fact of nutrition. And it's just, it seems so obvious. And the argument I'm making is not only is it unchallengeable, it makes no sense at all. There's a famous European physicist who would describe an idea like this as not even wrong. You know, it sounds reasonable, it sounds good, but it's like saying somebody got rich because they made more money than they spent. You know, if you get rich, you have to make more money than you spend. If you get fat, you have to take in more calories than you expend. But it tells you nothing about why fat is accumulating, why wealth is accumulating. You know, I make more money than I spend and I'm not rich. So it doesn't answer anything important about the problem. And somehow, and this is, like I said, this is why the community's response to my work is that I must be wrong. because I'm saying they embraced an idea that's meaningless as the cause of obesity, and everyone believes it. And at the end of, you know, if I don't know if you guys have comments to your podcast, but if you do, people will write in and say that clearly Taubes is an idiot because clearly people get fatter because they take in more calories. Whereas what I'm saying is when they get fatter, they take in more calories, but that's not why they get fat. This energy balance idea, and it just, it seems intuitively obvious, it's meaningless, but it's so deeply set. It's a fundamental idea in all of nutrition research, and it almost has to be right because it's too big to fail, put it that way, using Wall Street language. And yet, it's, you know, my book, Why We Get Fat, I call it the original sin. It's like once you make that assumption, everything after that is wrong. And you're also implying that obese people are obese because they have behavioral issues. They're somehow less than you or I who aren't obese. I mean, it's a whole chain of horrors that start with this simplistic idea that it's an energy balance disorder. And the other thing it's based on is, then here's the other thinking, and I would talk to research, you know, if you starve rats or humans, they'll get thinner. So people think that somehow tells them that obesity gets, if you remove food, people get thinner, therefore too much food is the reason they get fatter, and it's sophistic thinking, but that's what we've done.
Yeah, it just seems to me with the endocrinology and the neuroendocrinology, like that line of thinking is not substantiated whatsoever, as you've proven. I think it was Planck who said science advances by gravestones. What do you think is going to be enough to have a paradigm shift in thinking on sugar and carbohydrates and as far as the energy balance quotient, so to speak?
Well, I think what will happen is what you're seeing now, which is slowly. So if we were to go into the future 10, 15 years from now, I think this energy balance thinking will have vanished. I feel sorry for the people who have endowed chairs in energy balance, and they'll have to figure out a way to deal with it. But, you know, what the establishment will do is they'll slowly shift their thinking and they'll shift their discussions, and they'll claim 15 years ago that new research has demonstrated that there are other factors other than calories that influence fat accumulation. And these factors happen to be the effect of macronutrients on all these other factors, including fat accumulation. So you'll see a shift in the thinking, but with that shift will go this idea that we mostly knew this all along, and then new research clarified some of the issues. So nobody will ever have to say, we screwed up. I'm a big fan of saying people screwed up and saying I screwed up, because if I acknowledge that I screwed up, I'm more likely to do it right the next time. So I think it's important, but it probably isn't going to happen in this case. In the process, people like me will still be, you know, Taubes was just saying what everyone knew. And that way you don't have to, you know, really, again, you can change 180 degrees how you think, but you never had to acknowledge that you were thinking incorrectly to begin with. So I think that's what will happen. And you see this shift already to some extent. Even that New Yorker, that Harvard professor in the New Yorker, said new research is showing that there are factors other than calories. But calories are vitally important. And what I'm arguing is that they never should have gotten on the calorie idea to begin with. So we'll shift. And you see it's, you know, quite often now, like the idea that you should eat a low-fat diet to lose weight has pretty much vanished from what I see, at least on the internet. I'm sure there are doctors who still push it, and there are variations on it, but that's kind of evaporated. And pretty much everyone or a large percentage of the community says, well, clearly don't go eating sugar and white flour because that's particularly bad and those foods are particularly fattening. So I bet if you went back to your original corporate gym, their message will have changed. But they won't say our previous message was wrong.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, I suffer from ulcerative colitis, and it's something I've suffered from since I got out of the military. And I was put into the hospital about 6 months ago with a flare up. And I go in there, and the doctor whom I've explained to that whenever I eat sugar tends to cause me to flare up, they put me on a clear liquid diet. And I was looking at all the labels on the trays they were bringing me. And there was 120 grams of sugar minimal per meal. I mean, we're talking orange juice, you know, two Jell-Os. I forgot what else was in there, but it was ridiculous.
Yeah, that's sad. Hopefully that'll change. But the problem is those foods are cheap. They're inexpensive, whereas the healthy foods, not only are they more expensive, but and the non-sugar foods and non-white flour, they don't have the shelf life. So you can't just buy them packaged, put them in a closet and forget about it for 6 months and take it out and feed it to a patient. So you've got a whole host of issues that work to, you know, but I'm hoping that doctor, even that doctor will, if pointed out, will realize what they're doing. Again, it's hard to imagine hospital food getting better, but it's going to have to. I've had friends in the VA community try to argue, you know, that the cafeterias in the hospitals have to stop loading up the patients and the patients' families and the employees with sugar, and they've gotten nowhere. But here I'm optimistic. I think that situation will improve. It won't go as far as I necessarily think it should with the fat content of the diet. You know, I'm one of these people who thinks bacon and butter are health foods. I hope I'm right.
Amen.
And it's going to take a while before that shift is accepted. But we are making progress, so.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's because of people like you who write the works you do. And, you know, we definitely applaud you for that. I really want to be respectful of your time, and we're going to wrap up here in a second. But I had one question I really wanted to ask, and that's that, you know, there are so many opportunities out there, I think, for us to make scientific research better. And you know, in nutrition, of course, I still think that there's huge opportunity out there. But are there other opportunities out there that you see where we can start to question some of these things that might have been falsely reinforced, whether it be through, you know, academic tenure or nepotism within the journal community or, you know, anything like that? And where do you see yourself going? What's your future mission? What other kinds of things do you have your sights set on?
Well, that's another big question. Clearly, there are ideas that are still being ideas that are almost, well, very likely to be wrong, that are still being reinforced daily, and that the community doesn't really think through. So, you know, I'm thinking of there's a huge anti-red meat movement in the scientific community. And so from their perspective, based on a particular kind of study that we don't have the time to discuss, it looks like people who eat a lot of meat tend to be less healthy than people who don't. So one way to put it is, you know, the kind of person who, I live out here in Oakland, California, right next to Berkeley, and the people in Berkeley who go to yoga practice, and after yoga practice they go to a restaurant called Chez Panisse and have a vegetarian meal, tend to be healthier than truck drivers in West Virginia who are eating at Denny's. And then the researchers who study these populations say, well, clearly it's because the truck drivers at Denny's eat more meat. And then you get that's reinforced by the idea that livestock and meat production is very bad for the environment, and for it produces a significant amount of greenhouse gases, which is based on a whole host of assumptions that may or may not be true. And you get this whole world of people saying we should be eating mostly plant vegetarian diets. And those diets might be perfectly healthy or healthier than the kind of crap that we typically eat in the standard American diet and the sugar-rich, packaged foods we eat. But for the population that's obese and diabetic, it might just keep them obese and diabetic and never do any better than that. Whereas you put them on a animal product-rich diet, you know, one of these low-carb, high-fat diets where they're eating butter, bacon, animal products, you can actually reverse their conditions. So there's a whole world of things that have to be fixed, assuming I'm right, from, you know, the type of research that's done to how rigorously that research is interpreted to how it's sort of ubiquitously overinterpreted, and then the public health messages that come out of that. And then there's this, like I said, a large vegetarian movement in the United States who's, you know, might be completely right from a moral and ethical perspective, but support their belief system by arguing that people are healthier eating these ways, where they don't have no idea if that's true, and certainly not children. And, you know, I fight this battle every day on a, you know, from the pretty much the moment I wake up on emails to, helping design research projects that can actually study these issues, and to, you know, writing op-eds and future books. I seem to be in this for the long haul, whether I like it or not. You know, it's an interest. It's you've got these huge institutions with very well-meaning individuals who are believing, you know, basing their actions and their guidelines and their recommendations on what are quite likely erroneous beliefs. And a lot of work to be done, one way or the other.
Absolutely, absolutely. Andrew, did you have something else?
I want to ask one more question of Gary. Gary, I know you have two boys. I have five children of my own. In this age of information, how can we teach our young people to be able to think critically and delineate fact from fiction, which is what you've been, your work is centered around? So, you know, how do you go about teaching your children that?
Oh, boy, that's a hell of a question. And again, I don't think there's any short answer. If you have to somehow teach them to think critically, okay, that's, you know, to be skeptical of everything. And I think maybe I do it by always, you know, my children, like all kids these days, are probably on screens too much, and often they're telling me things that they think are true based on something they read or something their schoolmates have told them. And I happen to be a skeptical guy. Yesterday, a few days ago, was some spider crab that they said is the world's largest insect and is 8 feet, wide or tall. And I just said, okay, I find that hard to believe. And I want them to think, I want their first response to many things in life to be, I find that hard to believe. What's the evidence? And it has to be more than your friend John told you at school or I read it on the internet. So it's this process of teaching them to ask the question, what's the evidence? Then you get into issues where you want to, I don't know. I'm trying to get them off sugar. That's hard enough. Now you're asking me how to get them to think critically and not eat sugar when I'm telling them with the sugar that they have to trust me.
I'm with you, brother. I just wanted to hear your advice and your thoughts on it, because it is an uphill battle, but one very worth doing, I believe.
Well, it's funny, because one of the few, I gave one commencement address to a university in my life, and the commencement address was basically, how do you walk this balance? Remember, I said that, quoted this Richard Feynman, the Nobel laureate physicist, saying the first principle of science is you must not fool yourself, and you're the easiest person to fool. And I might say that should be the first principle of life, right? Is you must not fool yourself. But simultaneously, for you to do anything important in life, you have to believe in yourself. You have to believe in your ideas or the ideas of your church or the ideas of your officers or the ideas of your government. So you're constantly walking this tightrope between skepticism and thinking critically about what you're being told and believing what you have to believe to get things done. And I, what I said to these kids when I gave them the commencement address is, I don't know how to do that, but I know that that's what we have to do. So.
Well, that's great advice in and of itself. Absolutely. Yeah. Gary, so want to wrap things up here for you. Where can people find you on the internet? Do you hang out on Twitter or on Facebook?
Oh, I do tweet, but not very often. Gary Taubes is my Twitter handle. And I have a website, GaryTaubes.com, which I don't update enough because of all this other activity trying to tilt at windmills. And I do have a Facebook page that I don't update very much. So, and my books are available, you know, Amazon and Barnes & Noble and bookstores near you. If somebody wants to reach me, the best way to do it is through my website, GaryTaubes.com. And I do try to respond to most emails, although often after a podcast like yours, I'll be deluged and most will be some.
Well, I hopefully that, you know, everybody who listens to this podcast, which I, you know, I think that our community is very receptive to these sorts of ideas that can help them to live better. You know, hopefully you get some love out of this, too. I know you've been dealing with a lot of hate throughout your career. And I can imagine that. But it just goes to show you, you know, if you're out there and you're listening to this, and you've got an idea that's out of the norm, you know, stand up for it and put it out there. You'll find people who it does help. And, you know, for everybody out there who does want to hate on this or hate on Gary, you know, my biggest advice is to, you know, read the books and keep an open mind.
Nothing pisses me off more, frustrates me more than the people who, you know, are convinced you're wrong, but won't go through the trouble of reading the books. And again, I understand the logic, their logic, but it's irksome. The advantage, the thing that keeps this going, is that it works for most people. So you've got this dietary intervention, call it that, that's extraordinarily effective for many to most people who try it, at reversing what seems to be intractable conditions, obesity, type 2 diabetes, even things like epilepsy. So the idea is, and what I would want people to do is, you can try this. What I've done, my role in all this, is to say something that the medical community treated as quackery is not only like, makes extraordinary sense physiologically and is not going to kill you. And if it does kill you, I apologize, but it shouldn't kill you. So it's, you know, it makes sense biologically. It makes more sense than what we've been told to do. And it's, you know, the clinical trials exist to say it's healthier than what we've been told to do. And so you could try it and see for yourself, basically. And then it becomes about self-experimentation. Don't take my word for it. Try it. Read the books. And, you know, chances are you'll end up healthier and you'll decide it's worth it. And if you don't, stop doing it.
Absolutely. Andrew, any last words over here?
I think Gary just summed it up. And I think in a way that answers a lot of questions. Be open-minded, but be skeptic. And do the work and see what your results are. And I think that's good advice across the board. Gary, it's been an absolute pleasure, brother. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, guys. It's been great.
Yeah, seriously, thank you so much for coming on here. And I know that a lot of people are going to get a lot of benefit, one, from reading your books, and two, from your time here on this podcast. So thank you again for coming on.
All right, guys. So that was Mr. Gary Tobbs, author of The Case Against Sugar and Good Calories, Bad Calories. And I thought that that was an amazing conversation. And we try to bring you the best guests here on the Warrior Soul podcast. Again, if you like what we do here, if you like our interviews, if you like our content, or even if you don't, please write us a review on iTunes. Let us know how we're doing. Let us know how you like our guests. And let us know if we're actually bringing information that's helping you out. Also, I wanted to remind you that we have our website, The Warrior Soul Agoge, at www.warriorsoulagoge.com. You can come over there and check out the rest of our shows, some of our videos, and some of our articles. And we've also got some really great fitness programs up there for you, strength and conditioning programs, nutrition programs, and a host of other great things. We've also got some amazing supplements like Dynatropin and opportunities to get other products like exogenous ketones through Ketogenics, one of the best exogenous ketone companies on the market. And beyond that, I just think we're pretty freaking awesome. So come on over and check us out. And thank you so much for listening to this show and listening week after week to all of the awesome information we're able to bring you. We truly feel blessed here to be able to serve you. And this is why we do it, for you guys, to help you to live your best lives. So this is Chris. Get out there and live your best life. Out.